Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So day two of the walkout by the Chicago Teachers Union and the shutdown of the schools correspondingly. Saw yesterday there was a caravan around City Hall organized by the Chicago Teachers Union, but I haven't heard much in terms of an organized response or much of any response from those Chicago teachers who voted against leaving the classroom and going remote, more than one in four, according to the Chicago Teachers Union. And I haven't heard much from CPS parents either. Fortunately, we have one with us. Her name's Amy Jacobson.
Oh, yeah. Oh, hi. How are you? we're feeling a lot lied to, I can tell you that. And more parents are upset than they were the first time around. Or now, wait, this is the fifth time around we've had to go through this. But they've moved the goalposts so many times that the trust has eroded. And we're stuck.
It's eroded.
If it even existed in the first place. But, telling Peyton and Eli yesterday, I kept saying, listen, this is a work stoppage, an illegal work stoppage, but they don't want to go back to work until January 18th. And what that means is no remote learning, no in-person learning, no sports, no extracurricular. And my younger, he didn't take it well and resorted to some destructive behavior by the afternoon yesterday. And it was awful. And we sat down and like, let's talk about it. And I've tried to protect them, Dan. I got them enrolled in a private school. I did all that I could do as a parent. The other one's 18, so I can't tell them that they have to, move because he doesn't want to move. He's on the driveway home. He's a senior. But it's just devastating what we're doing to these kids all over again.
Can I fold in another group of stakeholders
Please.
We never hear from? just in terms of people we're not hearing from? Maybe they should be sought out. I mean, I know that's a lot to ask from those doughy teleprompter readers with room temperature IQs like Ben Bradley and his ilk in the Chicago Press Corps. But, I just throw it out there. You can feel free to reject it, as most of my suggestions are rejected by the larger, more enlightened Chicago power structure. The Chicago School Board. You ever notice how you always hear from Triple Threat? You always hear from her CPS superintendent du jour. So now it's Pedro Martinez. You hear from the union. Never hear from members of the school board. Why is there a school board there? We're supposed to go along with pretending that the school board is something that's important rather than just sort of a perfunctory legislative body that's required because the Chicago public school system is an independent government entity. And so they need a legislative branch. But a former state senator and candidate for mayor, Miguel Duvalier. He's the president of the Chicago School Board.
I forgot.
Who would remember?
I forgot, yes.
Senthil Rivalry is the vice president. Luisiana Melendez is a member. Amy Rome is a member. Lucino Sotelo is a member. Elizabeth Todd Breland is a member. And Dwayne Truss is a member. Has anybody ever heard these names before? Maybe with the exception of Duvalier. Has anybody heard from them in, the last 2 years?
No, because anytime they have a school board meeting, which is few and far between, but they do, it's a Zoom thing. And they only take 20 people. And I try every time and you get kicked out.
I
don't even know who these people are. No.
We talk about this context in, petition your school boards. You gotta go and make your case to, yes, administrative staff, but also and to your kids' teachers, but also to the school boards. I understand duly elected in the suburbs and appointed political flunkies in the city. But nonetheless, since we're calling out frauds, let's do so across the board. And this you know, these Politburo members on the school board are just as silent as, well, Chicago teachers, with few exceptions. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. I guess I give credit to the 10% of teachers who allegedly showed up yesterday. Maybe they hadn't gotten the word. I don't know.
No, they did. And I know at our school, there was about almost more than a fourth of the teachers showed up, which is something. But our principal sent out the most amazing email about why kids need to be back in school and talked about the numbers. I mean, 8 out of the 152 staff members self-reported positive during the winter break, so some of them are already back. That's not bad. And of the students, 35 out of 1,473 have self-reported that they tested positive during the break, and that was at the beginning of the break, so they can come back.
Why did CPS shut down the access to the remote tools to provide instruction for those teachers who did want to teach? There was a guy from Benito Juarez High School who said, I logged in to start the class and do what we did for the last year going remote, and I couldn't get in.
Well, wait, was he inside the school?
No.
Oh, no, you have to be inside the school to access remote learning. If you
try
to do it outside of school. Because they don't want to go to remote learning at a district level. What they want to do is take this school by school, classroom by classroom.
No. I understand what they want to do, and I understand what the union has done. And now it's time for evasive action. It's not just, here's what I want to do. Well, what you want to do, you're unable or unwilling to do because nothing is happening.
I know what they're saying.
I know what they're saying, how does that fly? That doesn't fly. You make the necessary adjustments to do the best you can for the most you can when you can. That's not what CPS is doing. So now we're just going to do nothing until January 18th, and then we'll see what CTU decides in terms of whether or not anybody's allowed to do anything. And CPS just follows along, and we're supposed to pretend that Lightfoot and Martinez
are in control.
Or are serious about anything other than just bitching about their circumstances.
Well, listen to this. It's like Lightfoot has an epiphany for the first time ever what the CTU is really about.
And going fully remote. And don't kid yourselves that it's going to be January 18th. They first told us it would just be today. And then at the last minute yesterday, they said January 18th, conveniently right after Martin Luther King Day. But do we have any guarantee from them that this arbitrary date that they picked will be the date? We don't. We don't. So the doors of our schoolhouse are open. We want our students and our teachers and our staff back on Friday.
But, you know, arbitrary dates, she's the queen of arbitrary dates.
Well, exactly.
I mean, we don't know when mask mandates are going to end. Everything's arbitrary. So they learned from her.
Well, they didn't learn from her. They're just better practitioners of the dark arts of power politics. And this is the point I made yesterday, too. Oh, the fear-mongering. She thought, triple threat, thought that she was the only one who could fear-monger for political gain. Well, it turns out the Chicago Teachers Union can do the same, and they've been doing it a lot longer than her, so they're better at it. Oh, I'm the only one who gets to do this. I'm the only one who gets to be capricious. I'm the only one who gets to say my way. I'm the only one who gets to engage in rank hypocrisy. I'm the only one who gets to, you know, pound my little fists on the lectern and demand my way. Oh, okay. Well, you can do that, and then we're going to do that too, and we'll all vote our shares and see who's in charge. And again, just like during the strike, little triple threat, not in charge. Just like little tiny dancer before her, not in charge. CTU in charge. And the teachers inside those ranks, you just don't hear from, with very few exceptions. And the parents, I mean, one off, you know, these reporters go out and throw. Does anybody know a CPS parent that I can talk to? Okay, here, there, we got a CPS parent. But that's not a response. There is no organized response to this.
But we need to organize.
Where's the Chicago City Council? Where's the Chicago School Board? Where's the state legislature? Where's the governor? They're abdicated. They're all gone. There is no play here because there is no constituency for the kids.
And I don't know if you went over this yesterday, but last night she said, she talked about the list of demands, one of them being that they want to perform tests on every kid, regardless
opt-out
of parental
versus opt-in.
Opt-out. Yes. Yep. So no parental if say. No parental say.
That we're going to be performing a quasi-medical procedure on children without their parents' knowledge or consent. Just ponder that for a moment.
You can do it for
abortions. As a parent of a child, I would be outraged if a school system was doing anything with my child that I didn't know about and I didn't affirmatively authorize.
Right, except for, you know, killing an unborn child.
Right. Yeah,
of course.
The hypocrisy.
Of course the hypocrisy. Yesterday, or the day before, and we talked about it yesterday, she made a case for school choice. Parents should have the choice to act in the best interest of their kids. Well, great. Then go to your political flunkies on that school board and the political flunky du jour, that's the CEO of the schools, and say, we're going to take all the Fed money, the Fed funding money we received to reopen the school safely, quote unquote. So since we're not using it, we're just going to create scholarships that parents can access to send their kids to schools that are open since our schools are not. Yeah, do something transformative. Do something that is a substantive response to the dictatorial nature of the Chicago Teachers Union. No, no, no. It's just easier to offer these, you know, wails from the dais. It's the plaintiff cries about how concerned she is, how much she recognizes, how much damage her policies did over the last year, and she doesn't want to be party to that anymore. And also, it's nice electoral politics a year out from her reelection to juxtapose yourself against the Chicago Teachers Union and pretend they're not fellow travelers. And this is not just an internecine fight between members of the Politburo, who gets to be the central planner in charge.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy talking about the big walkout. Of course, I'm referencing the walkout of Starbucks employees in Buffalo because the Starbucks there was unsafe. We're going to see more of this.
Oh, my gosh. Can I get coronavirus with my latte?
Unionized Starbucks baristas walking out in Buffalo over the spike in Omicron, much like we're seeing unionized teachers walk out in Chicago, suing to walk out in New York, considering throwing down rhetorically at this point, walking out in San Francisco, Chicago leading the way of the pandemicists in education, must be proud. Here's Stacey Davis Gates. She's the mouthpiece for the Chicago Teachers Union. And she spoke yesterday about, referencing some of the demands that are being lodged by the union in order to, return to school safely. Of course, safely.
That we're going to be performing.
There is not an agreement without safety, and safety is also staffing. Safety is also staffing. Yes. You cannot have a building full of young people without, proper supervision.
Need more hires at CPS. CPS is understaffed.
Oh, right.
The only thing CPS is losing is students. It's not losing the adults, because the system actually works out fairly nicely for most of the adults, as far as I can tell. So that's the old positioning of the union. I mean, these are the sorts of things that you hear during teacher strike. If it works to go on strike, why wouldn't it work to walk out during a pandemic?
312-642-5600. 312-642-5600. Turnkey.pro answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. I couldn't attend the press conference last night, but Mary Lightfoot looked at reporters and put her finger out, and she begged them to report this fact about what happened last time during remote learning.
I need you to report about the fact that 100,000 children were disconnected and disengaged when we were fully remote. 100,000, mostly black and brown and poor kids who weren't learning and who we have to...
I'm so tired of listening to her. Yeah, we heard that the other day. And we reported it, places that did report it, like this show, get ridiculed for reporting it. She doesn't have any time for you at her press conferences, nor does Jelly Belly. But they're the great guarantors of a bright future for all of those students in CPS. A majority of brown and black kids. Yeah, no kidding. 90% of the school district of 300,000, so you say, are black and brown kids. Right, I know. And they're being well served by their black and brown city leaders?
Well, if they never let remote learning happen in the first place, we wouldn't be going through this all over again. But they were scared back there. They're the ones who instilled fear in everyone.
Lori Lightfoot's play is moral indignation and feigned outrage to cover her tracks. She's just another COVID criminal. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Marvin, Burlington, Wisconsin.
Good morning. She's become, and her people of her ilk are becoming victims of their own philosophy. I mean, they're the ones who think that the state is the almighty. So I find it just humorous in a way that she's complaining that the state is going to have their children tested without the parents' consent. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're all for that. They're all for that in other circumstances. I just, you know, where was she spouting these 100,000 kids back when they did it the first time, or back when the teachers actually have a strike for no damn good reason? I mean, if you go back before COVID, the teachers were on strike, and they're in the top five of being compensated in the country.
And they still got paid during the strike.
Thanks for the call, Marvin.
They got paid, and she better not pay them.
They're in the top one in the country.
She better not pay them for these work stoppages.
Oh, please. Of course they're going to be paid. Just, I mean, can we just stop with this? She better not. I mean, we sound like her. You better not do this. It's done. Here's what's going to happen. And who's going to stop it?
So she's saying they better get back to school on Friday. Tomorrow they're not getting paid. Sure. I've heard that before.
Come on.
I mean, the union walks all over her. She has tire tracks on her face. Come on.
Paul in Plainfield.
Yeah, hey, Dan. Just out of curiosity, where do you think the end game is on this? Because we talk about the daily things, you know, whatever's happening today. But where are we looking at 6 months, 9 months, or even after the midterms? When the Republicans win in the midterms, is that going to change anything?
Well, what's anything? I mean, that's pretty broad. Are we talking about the Chicago public school system, or are we talking about freedom in this country? Or anything?
Yeah, freedom. So the Republicans win. Will COVID finally come to an end? Will these lockdowns? Will the COVIDians finally lose?
Thanks for the call. I mean, I would say this. Yes, I think that it would be a paradigm shift if Republicans win in the House and Senate, because you have some Republicans on the Hill that are committed to a reckoning with the public health monsters inside the Beltway at places like CDC and NIH. And I think you know who they are at this point. They're committed to a reckoning, and put Rand Paul at the top of that list. So it would change. Now, they'll still have cover from the White House and from the press corps. But at least the battle is joined, and they don't get a free pass when it comes to congressional hearings being held to account, action that Congress can take, funding, you know, control of the purse strings in the House and Senate. So, yes, it's not a 180 with Republicans regaining control of both chambers. But there will be changes afoot, and the landscape will adjust accordingly. Now, in states that are failed and are loving it, like Illinois, and in big cities that are cratering, like Chicago and New York and Los Angeles and San Francisco, will Republican control at the federal level change what they're doing at the local level? No.
No.
Did a Republican president and Republican control of both chambers change what they were doing at the local level in the first 2 years of Trump? No.
No.
So, of course, it's not.
So, as a lawyer, they did file an unfair labor practices complaint. But she still is placating to them. I mean, wake up, woman.
Litigation is litigation. Where we should get this done is at the bargaining table. It doesn't make sense that we've been at this for 6 months and we don't have a deal. We need to stop CTU moving the goalposts, narrow the range
blah,
of issues.
Blah, 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 blah. So what?
Well, file the unlay. I mean, go for it legally in court.
What does go for it?
Shut them down.
What does
that mean? She's like, well, we're not, you know, we want to fight. We filed this complaint, but we want to do it. You know, we want to work this out, you know, face to face.
Yeah.
Like,
at the bargaining
table.
I know.
Throw daggers now, woman. Because they're not going to conform to anything she says.
Well,
my kids are not going to go back to school. Then January 18th is going to come. Then they're going to demand remote learning again for the whole district instead of school by school.
It's real simple.
And then we'll be February.
Give the teachers union, do what you normally do. Give the teachers union 100% of what they want, and then they'll come back.
And what they want. They want N95 masks. They got them, though. Every teacher and CPS, those arrived yesterday. Arriving today are N95 masks for all the kiddies that they were concerned about.
Wonderful.
So, you know, they're giving them what they want. But what they want is daily testing for everybody.
More staff, even parents.
Testing,
whatever they want. Whatever they want. The parents don't seem to be putting up much of a fight. I mean, is Triple Threat a fiscal conservative all of a sudden? She cares about other people's money? No, she doesn't. So just roll over. Do what you do. Do what the city does. Roll over for the teachers union. Simple. And then you can get back to the maleducation of the vast majority of 300,000 kids. But at least it'll be in classroom. Wonderful. And we'll just carry on. And the CPS will continue to produce what is produced for the last half a century, except it'll be worse. Just when you think it can't get worse, it will get worse. Because the students coming out of this generation of K-12 will be even less equipped for the real world than previous generations. And how have those generations fared?
No, we're seeing students who had no prior history of social, emotional, or mental health challenges now having depression, suicidal thoughts, lack of motivations, feeling of isolation, self-harm, anxiety, and we're doing it to them all over again. It is child abuse. And there's no end in sight.
Right, so it'll be worse.
And I'm not lying to my children. I'm not going to, whatever. I'm going to tell them the truth, which I did yesterday, and they said, what? And I said, I'm not staying here. I am not going to be here in this godforsaken hell city and hell state if we're going to be locked out for the whole month of January. We should just go somewhere where we can be free, and maybe you'll have remote learning. Maybe you won't. Maybe you'll have sports. Maybe you won't. But this, you know, vacillation is just killing our kids, and nobody cares.
This is not to say that there are not good examples of teachers in the Chicago public school system. We've talked to one many times over the years named Joseph O'Call, who's a math teacher at Inglewood STEM Academy, who also started a chess club there that went on to win tournaments, you know, a bunch of black girls winning chess tournaments. I mean, is there a better story? This should be made into a movie. Instead, it's a story that very few people know.
Well, I don't know if you know, too. He's battling cancer now, and he's still not afraid to teach in the classroom.
Joseph O'Call is an example of the great teachers that make a difference in the lives of their students, and they exist, including in Chicago. But it's a system that is, I say again, for the 1 millionth time, incapable of producing under any circumstances, no matter the talent, what it promises to produce. Incapable, structurally incapable. People don't want to believe it. Oh, we just do this, we just do that, and just tinker on the margins a little bit more, pay a little bit more, get a new superintendent, elect a school board. Wrong, wrong, wrong. But there are Joseph O'Calls that are out there and speaking out, and it's a sad thing that more teachers are not, more of the good teachers, to provide examples to the others and perhaps inspiration for parents to be a little bit more aggressive than they've been. Joseph O'Call, by the way, our listeners have donated. We did fundraising for Joseph O'Call's chess team here. Our listeners, our generous listeners, have donated to send their kids pre-pandemic to chess tournaments.
Yeah.
And nobody here has a stake in Inglewood STEM Academy, but we believe in being our brother's keeper, and that's why we do it. And that's why Joseph O'Call does it, too, even as he's battling cancer. He was on with Tucker Carlson last night,
Good.
And Tucker asked him, well, why are you showing up?
I joined the Chicago Public Schools as a teacher, first and foremost as a teacher. And my role, I believe my role, should be inside the classroom with my students. Should not be in the picket line. I did not join CPS to be a union member. First and foremost, to be a teacher. And secondly, I believe that there are ways to fight City Hall. You don't dangle the plight of the kids in the middle of the fight just to seek your demands. There are other ways. I believe there are other ways. I have nothing against the union, but I have something against people using the union as a tool for political gain. And that's my stand. And that's why I feel that despite my battling cancer, I still have a role to play right now and just want to make my life relevant somehow. The thought that I can still be of service to my students and I can touch their lives and make a difference in their lives.
It's making me cry.
I tell you what, I love that simple, elegant idea that Ocal put forward. I want to make my life relevant.
Yeah.
That's, to me, one of the saddest commentaries of where we're at during this COVIDian dystopian nightmare we've imposed on ourselves. So many people want to live irrelevant lives. You don't want your life to be relevant to
so
your kids, to professionally. Joe Ocal, I want in my little place where I teach with my kids, the chess team I started, I don't care about my illness. I still want to make my life relevant. I still have something to give. That is a philosophy that is in short supply right now. Tom in Oswego.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. First of all, you probably know I don't have kids in the school system anymore. But every morning I wake up and I hear what's going on in the school system, and it really my heart just aches. What we're doing to the children, and Dan, not only the children, but I think what needs to be talked about more is the adults also. I'm a small business guy. I deal with a lot of business people, homeowners, people who own big buildings in Chicago. The stress out there is off the charts. People are ready to crack. And I'm not kidding. I see it in my family. Fortunately, my faith and our strong family unit keeps us together. But there's so many people out there that don't have that. And I know there's not a mechanism for this, but I wish that some of these politicians could be brought up on charges of child abuse. They don't care what they're doing as long as they get their damn pension and their health benefits. And I know teachers, friends of mine who are retired, getting six-figure pensions. They don't care about the kids. Well, I don't know what's happened to us. I think we've all sort of fallen into this well of security. We want people to tell us what to do, because then there's no consequences if something goes wrong. Somebody told me what to do. So if it goes wrong, it's not my fault. We've lost this independence. Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Tom. Appreciate it. Frank, Arlington Heights.
Hey, good morning. Yeah, well, and to respond to one of your earlier callers, this is almost like the fourth turning that Strauss and Howe talked about in their book. We're almost getting omnicidal. You just feel it out there. All these people standing in line to get tested, people going to the hospitals to go get tested when they're asymptomatic. I mean, this is nuts. It really is. But Dan, I also wanted to congratulate you on your speech yesterday regarding Bennett Academy. That was almost like Pericles' funeral oration. It was great.
Wow.
I watched it twice. Yeah. It really was.
High praise. Thank you very much, yeah. Frank. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I'm going to do my Karnak impersonation here. a UC Irvine doctor.
Yeah.
Tennis star Novak Djokovic and Green Bay quarterbacks, Green Bay Packers quarterback Aaron Rodgers.
Yeah.
Who are three people growing in my admiration?
I love when you, can you do the whole show like that?
As Johnny?
Yeah.
Or really as Dana Carvey doing Johnny Carson, which is the actual impersonation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That would be weird. No, so I won't.
Okay, fine.
Aaron Rodgers took out after
Huff. You've got a crush on him.
You'll understand why.
Okay.
Not just because of some of his comments on his buddy Pat McAfee's podcast, but also because of yesterday having to respond, having to defile himself by responding to the comments of one Chicago native. I think he lives up in Deerfield. Hub Arkish.
Oh, no.
The Pro Football Weekly used to be, maybe still is, I don't know who watches them anymore, these like Sunday pregame shows before the Bears go out to get their asses kicked by the Packers.
Hey, they won their last two games, okay.
Yeah. Hub Arkish, it turns out he's one of the sports writers who gets to vote on who the NFL MVP should be.
Okay.
And he has he was openly critical of Aaron Rodgers for being unvaccinated. Aaron Rodgers was asked about that, saying Aaron Rodgers can't be the MVP because he's unvaccinated, so he's a bad person. That's what Hub Arkish essentially said. Here's what Aaron Rodgers essentially said.
Think of one of the 50 voters coming out and saying yesterday, quote, "I don't think you can be the biggest jerk in the league and punish your team and your organization and your fan base the way he did and be the MVP. I think he's a bad guy, and I don't think a bad guy can be the MVP at the same time."
I think he's a bum. I think he's an absolute bum. He doesn't know me. I don't know who he is. No one knew who he was probably until yesterday's comments. But I mean, and I listened to the comments, but to say he had his mind made up in the summertime, in the offseason, that, you know, I had zero chance of winning MVP. In my opinion, should exclude, you know, future votes. You know, his problem isn't with me being a bad guy or the biggest jerk in the league. Because he doesn't know me. He doesn't know me. He doesn't know anything about me. I mean, I've never met him. I've never had lunch with him. I've never had an interview with him. His problem is I'm not vaccinated. You know, so if he wants to go on a crusade and collude and come up with an extra letter to put on the award just for this season and make it the most valuable vaccinated player, then he should do that. But he's a bum, and I'm not going to waste any time worrying about that stuff. He doesn't know I do. I am. He's never talked to me in his life. But it's unfortunate that those sentiments, it's surprising that he would even say that, to be honest. But yeah, I knew this was possible. Talked about it on McAfee weeks ago. But crazy.
Rob Domofsky?
Crazy.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636, type in DA. DA, oh my God, I'm having brain fog. You know what I'm talking about. It's our turnkey text line. But, you know, who else is in love with Aaron Rodgers now?
MVP, the most valuable vaccinated player this year, for this year only. I like that. So just so you understand, and so it make it clear, even Aaron Rodgers can be touched by the COVIDian mobs who run around just, and Hub Arkish is part of it. I mean, so is the sports press corps. I mean, how many examples do we need before we fully understand that the professional sports media corps, they're just an affiliate of the D.C.
Right.
political press corps, which is and all of its regional outposts like the Chicago political press corps.
Well, they listen to President Biden, who says, you know, this is a pandemic of the unvaccinated.
Yeah,
so
they,
all we're doing is slamming and shaming unvaccinated people.
Well, and
for
they
really no reason, because everybody right now who has COVID is vaxxed or boosted.
And they aspire to be part of the political press corps, to be taken seriously as journalists.
Yeah.
And so this is why so many of them play along, like Hub Arkish and most of them. They're pathetic, and they don't know anything either, which actually qualifies them to be part of the Chicago or the D.C. political press corps. Pandemic of the unvaccinated, right? Mm-hmm. At a time when we have an all-time high in infections in a country that's 62% fully vaccinated. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And although we don't use the term fully vaccinated anymore, folks, please update your nomenclature. Wait, so you don't get in trouble with your overlords.
What is it?
Up to date.
Oh.
Up to date. We don't use fully vaccinated because you will never be fully vaccinated. You can only be up to date. So this is the verbiage.
Right. Michelle Walensky said that yesterday. That's right.
Both Walensky and Fauci are promoting. Oh. You are not fully vaccinated. No one is fully vaccinated. No one will ever be fully vaccinated. All you can accomplish is being up to date with the mandates of people like Hubarkish. That's how you want to live your life. It's something that he points out, though, that is happening to people that don't have the profile to push back in the way that Aaron Rodgers does. If you're not up to vaccinated, am I vaccinated? Are you up to date? Did you get boosted? If you're not boosted, you're not vaccinated. You're not even up to date. An example of what the attitude is of the Hubarkishes, and this is from people inside the public health community, so you can understand where simpletons like Arkish would just take their marching orders. Listen to this exchange between CNN's John Berman, sorry he couldn't make the New Year's Eve party, and NYU Medical School Medical Ethics Professor Arthur Kaplan on what should be done to the unvaccinated.
Oh, no.
By and large, if you're vaccinated and boosted, even if you get infected, you're going to be fine. You're going to be fine here. It's the unvaccinated who are going to be hurt. So why should anyone who is boosted bother at this point to do anything that makes the unvaccinated more safe?
Well, look. I want us to act as a community. I want us to act as a team. When you're fighting a war, you need all hands on deck. I don't want to reject those who still haven't done the right thing. I'll condemn them. I'll shame them. I'll blame them.
There you go.
But I don't want to exclude them. They've got to come around. We can't win this war. We're going to be talking about COVID this time next year if we don't get more people to do the right thing. So we can't write them off. We can penalize them more. We can say, you got to pay more on your hospital bill if you weren't vaccinated. You can't get life insurance or disability insurance at affordable rates if you aren't vaccinated. Those companies should not treat us as equals in terms of what the financial burdens are that that disease imposes. So I can think of a number of ways in which we should say, here's the stick, get on board. At the same time, we do need everyone. It's a war. You got to have...
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that's the thing. These are the idiots that think that even if everyone in the world or in America got vaccinated, that we would eradicate COVID. That's not going to happen. What he suggested is the same thing that I think it's his name, State Rep Carroll, who said, you know, charge more for people who are unvaccinated to go to the hospital. Remember that?
Right. Yes.
That died.
Yeah, exactly. Be as punitive as you can be. But that's the left's position with respect to those with whom they disagree. Across the board, writ large. Here's sort of the COVIDian pandemicist leftist philosophy summed up nicely by Judge Schmales.
If you understand and abide by the rules of decent society, Danny, there's a lot of, badness in the world today. I see it in court every day. I've sentenced boys younger than you to the gas chamber.
Oh.
Didn't want to do it, because I owed it to them.
Exactly. They're doing this for our own good. This is what you heard from Arthur Kaplan. Yeah, I agree with shaming and being punitive, no life insurance, exorbitant rates for health insurance, don't treat them equally under the law. We're doing this for them. Berman asks, why shouldn't we just let them go? Oh, no, we can't let them go. We have to do it together. But it's not because we're going to win some battle. It's because we're going to impose our will. We talked about this piece a bit yesterday, Michael Anton's piece in at the Claremont Institute, the AmericanMind.org, mm-hmm. Blue America's messaging problem. It's clear Blue America is not really trying to win over Red. Rather, its aim is to rally its side to permanent offense, in part to avoid infighting, and to guilt Reds into lying down and taking it. They will not let you go. Their attitude is this: we must rule you punitively forever, and if you so much as complain, you are literally Hitler. All shall love me and despair. That is the message. And that's the attitude that permeates all of their public pronouncements and proposed policies. You shall love me and despair. Obedience or silence, actually both. We only take compliments here. That's what you're hearing. That's what Aaron Rodgers is feeling, too. And I'm sure many more of you in your daily lives that, as I said, don't have the platform, the media, societal power that Aaron Rodgers does to push back and to put little petty wannabe tyrants like Hub Arkush in their place.
Well, just so you know, John Berman, he does sit on a booster seat on the anchor set. Ancillary issue, but I thought I'd let you know.
Sure. More little tiny man. Little people yeah. that have Napoleonic complexes. You mm-hmm. see them in politics. You see them in the media. No question about it. Now, before we just focus on Rodgers, I also want to fold in Novak Djokovic, best tennis player in the world, who is being deported from Australia. I mean, Australia, but one of the most COVIDian nations in the world, lockdown nations in the world.
Why would he even go there?
He didn't get vaccinated, not going to get vaccinated, so they're not going to let him play in the Australian Open. And the response, and he doesn't seem to care. No. He didn't even offer any comment. But that's not good enough. Rafael Nadal.
He's already had COVID, too.
What's that?
I thought he's already had COVID, too. Who cares?
Rafael Nadal, you know, one of his rivals, also top right. tennis player in the world. At the end of the day, the only thing I can say is we've been going through very challenging times. A lot of families have been suffering a lot during the last 2 years with the pandemic. I mean, it's normal that people here in Australia get very frustrated with the case because they have been going through a lot of very hard lockdowns and a lot of people were not able to come back home. From my point of view, that's the only thing I can say is I believe in what the people who knows about medicine say. And if the people says that we need to get vaccinated, we need to get the vaccine. That's Rafael Nadal. The only thing clear is if you're vaccinated, you can play in the Australian Open and everywhere. And the world, in my opinion, has been suffering enough to not follow the rules. Just follow the rules. Or you're yep. a bad person. Because they're suffering in the world.
Right. Shut so up. You're not, get your vaccine. Put your mask on.
If they're suffering in the world, you can't ask questions. Because the people in charge, the experts, they know. So just follow them. Because they've produced such an impressive record of leading people away from suffering, haven't they? Paul and Worth, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yes, two quick things. Hub Arkush, after Biden won the election, said that he knew that Biden would bring some serious effort to tackle the COVID problem, unlike Trump. And the second thing is, over the past 20 years, the average adult American who gets vaccinated for the seasonal flu runs between 42% and 45%. Now that 70% of adult Americans have had at least one jab, they should declare victory and leave the rest of us alone. Thanks.
Thanks, Paul. Appreciate it. I want to get to the University of California Irvine doctor, too, Aaron Carity. As well to close out my Karnak session. But first, okay. Greg and LaGrange.
Hey, how you doing today? Amy, glad you're back. Dan, the last 2 days have been a tour de force. Aaron Rodgers, Aaron Rodgers has gone up. My esteem for him is just unhinged right now. Novak Djokovic has always been a favorite of mine, but the guy that's really suffered, Rafael Nadal, you're dead to me. I mean, that's a pathetic excuse. You know what's ironic about that medical expert out of New York City? Reminds me of the comment of Joseph Bronowski from The Ascent of Man when he goes back and looks at Auschwitz and says, it wasn't the gas or it wasn't the poison or the flames that killed these people. It was the absolute certainty of the people that knew that they were right. And that's where we're at. These people are dead to me. They are dead to me. They are dead. We're walking among the dead. They don't care about human lives. All they care about themselves and is their safety. They are dead to me. And I think it's about time people start to wake up that the only thing more pathetic than our leadership are the people that allow them to get away with it.
Thanks for the call, Greg. Good comments. Dr. Aaron Carity, University of California, Irvine, also a physician and medical ethics professor like Dr. Kaplan there you heard from, who wants to join the John Berman CNN mob and persecute the unvaccinated.
Right.
He's filed a lawsuit over his termination. He had COVID. Here is a blog post. He just described what's happened to him. I worked in person at the hospital every day during the pandemic, seeing patients in our clinic, psychiatric wards, emergency rooms, hospital wards, including COVID patients in the ER, ICU, and medicine wards. As our chief ethics consultant, I had countless conversations with families of patients dying of COVID, tried my best to console and guide them in their grief. When our pregnant residents were worried about consulting on COVID patients, the administration reassured these residents they had no elevated risk from COVID, a claim without any evidential basis at the time, and which we now know to be false. I saw the COVID consults for these worried residents even when I was not covering the consult service. He talks about the supply of N95 masks in the beginning were short. Hospital kept them under lock and key. He continued his work. I was the only faculty member at University of California, Irvine, who directed courses all 4 years of our medical students' curriculum, so I knew the students as well as anyone in the university. And he goes on to talk about his work during this time and how he interacted with both his colleagues and the students. Everyone at the university seemed to be a fan of my work until suddenly they were not. Once I challenged one of their policies, I immediately became a threat to the health and safety of the community. No amount of empirical evidence about natural immunity or vaccine safety and efficacy mattered at all. The university's leadership was not interested in scientific debate or ethical deliberation. When I was placed on unpaid suspension, I was not permitted to use my paid time off. I was ordered to stay off campus because I was not vaccinated, but I could also not take vacation at home because I was not vaccinated. In violation of every basic principle of just and fair employment, the university tried to prevent me from doing any outside professional activities while I was on unpaid suspension. In an effort to pressure me to resign, they wanted to restrict my ability to earn an income, not only at the university, but outside the university as well. It was dizzying and at times surreal. And of course, this has happened to other professors in the academy we've talked to, including at George Mason University. But this is what's happening to people who refuse to love the pandemicists and despair.
Well, I mean, I'm sure, I don't know if you talked about it yesterday, but the 700 staff members from Mayo Clinic who are gone because they're unvaccinated.
Yeah.
Heroes to zeros, you know?
Does that make the Mayo Clinic a better hospital? Probably not.
No, because they have less staff.
Does that improve the quality of care? Probably not.
No, it doesn't.
And we're seeing this across systems, healthcare systems, K through 12 systems. Are we improving the outcomes for the students or the patients?
No.
Probably not, but that doesn't matter because
comply or die.
The moral rectitude of the left is what's important. Your two choices, obedience or silence. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We're standing by. We're going to have our friend Earl STEM Academy math teacher and chess coach, Earl STEM Academy in Inglewood, by the way.
Oh, good, good.
Joseph O'Call on momentarily after his star turn on Tucker. Mainly, we want to have him on to make sure he remembers who made him before he became a big star and got on Tucker Carlson show.
Dan, it's all you.
Yeah, right.
Enough about you. What do you think of you?
So what's the plan for tomorrow with CPS since you're a CPS mom?
Okay, here's Pedro Martinez. And try to wrap your head around this, okay?
Our approach forward is going to be starting Friday. I welcome all my staff to come into the buildings.
Okay.
I welcome to come and join us to support our families, to support our children. And we will build plans as we support children and, again, allow schools starting as early as Friday to have children coming in for all services. And we'll continue gradually building up as we continue to have these conversations with CTU.
Okay, so if for some reason the strike of lightning happens and all the teachers return or a majority return to a certain school, then the kids can go back to that school. And then if kids are there and school teachers are there, then there can be extracurricular activities too.
Well, so, I mean, then how is this actually going to be implemented? Because I understand from somebody who texted us yesterday that, for example, Keller Elementary, which is a magnet school for gifted kids, that the majority of teachers voted to stay in the classroom and continue teaching. So why
so
doesn't
they'll
CP-
be open tomorrow?
Well, so Martinez says, how do we know? How do we know they're going to flip the switches and allow them in?
Well, all I can tell you is what I talked to our principal, and she's like, the teachers that are here will teach, and starting tomorrow, they're welcome to come in because the teachers know that if they don't show up to work tomorrow, they're not getting paid.
They don't know.
Although
that.
We've Nobody heard believes this a that. Thousand
times. Nobody believes that. The only way they're coming back is if there's communication, not just among the teachers and administrative staff, but also with the parents, so they know that it's okay to send the kids to school.
Right.
So to me, it seems like, I mean, this is a centralized Politburo like Soviet era system. So I wouldn't, because somebody makes an announcement, that doesn't mean it's going to happen.
No, I know.
And so, you know, if there are parents and teachers, administrators out there, you know, you better be communicating within your little community to make sure it does happen as long as CPS is saying it can happen.
Well, and each principal is going to be writing an email to parents to let them know what the situation is, how many teachers are there, how many are willing to. And they didn't cross the picket line. This is a work stoppage, whatever. But how many teachers are in school willing to teach? But I wanted you to get inside the head of here is a CPS teacher. She's also a parent. And this is how she's been brainwashed.
Nobody likes remote learning. I don't like it as a mother. I don't like it as a teacher. But I much prefer it to sick kids, to sick families, to overwhelmed hospitals.
The transmission rate, everyone listen up, between student to teachers at CPS reported so far possibly 2 to 5 cases total out of 341,000 students. But for some reason, no one's listening to that science or data.
Because they're cultists. And, I mean, we've been going through this and trying to explain this for months and months on end.
Mm-hmm.
You can't deprogram. This is what Dr. Robert Malone was saying to Joe Rogan in his recent interview that people were talking about and that we played clips from the other day. You cannot data and science your way to reason with a cultist. They have to be deprogrammed or they have to come out of their delusions, I don't know, through some facilitator on their own. And it's going to be one by one. The delusion happens in mass and the walk back to reason happens individually, which is why it takes so long. So when you hear these people and you're incredulous, I mean, I am too, but you have to understand the dynamic. So somebody around her that she trusts, I guess, needs to get to her.
Right.
Or, you know, the leadership, at the leadership level, you need to have people with enough courage to say, this is the right thing to do. I'm going to present the facts, the data, the information, the science. And this is what we're going to do. This is my charge. And if people don't like it, they don't have to participate because it's a free society. We're not running around trying to impose our will. We're not running around trying to punish people who disagree. That's what the COVIDians do. But understand, this is the way that we have to go because it's the way that is supported by the evidence and common sense.
And the evidence says
and we just don't
it
have
is
that.
Safer. No, it,
we don't
right
have enough people doing that.
It is safer for the kids to be in class than in home. Kids, well, Dr. Wardy pointed out yesterday.
We talked about it yesterday.
Okay, well, I'm just saying that she repeated it again, and it can repeat it again until people flip and listen and open up their ears. But there's a higher transmission rate at home, 5 times higher than there is at school. And they've spent $100,000 on HEPA filtration systems. They did everything the union has asked them to do.
It doesn't matter.
And it's still not enough.
It doesn't matter. It does not matter. It will not matter.
Well, I'm sending
what
my
we
kids
say
to school tomorrow.
Does not matter, will not matter. What people like Joseph O'Call do, that's what matters.
Yep.
Joseph O'Call, math teacher, chess coach, Earl STEM Academy, Inglewood on the South Side, joins us now. Joe, thanks for being with us again. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. And good morning, everyone.
Congratulations.
Oh, by the way, I'm connected with another school. I transferred last year, and I was with Earl STEM Elementary School for 5 years, but due to the distance problem, when I had to drive around for about an hour going one way, so it was a bit stressful for me considering my health condition, so I decided to transfer nearby where I live, so that's
okay,
where
so
I am now.
Do you want to tell us?
Ella Flagyang Elementary School.
And where's that? Because people probably want to send their kids there to be taught by you.
Thank you. It's on 1434 North Parkside Avenue in Chicago.
Okay. All right. Glad to have that update. You were on Tucker Carlson's show last night talking about your perspective, and you just... And we played it a bit earlier in the show. You just gave such a beautiful statement about being a teacher, what motivates you, to continue teaching even as you're battling cancer. And so, I mean, I just think, you know, you're such an inspiration and a shining example of what a teacher is supposed to be and the attitude they're supposed to have. I mean, just for our audience, tell us again why you're motivated to continue to press on within CPS despite your health condition and despite all of the consternation you've had to endure at the hands of the Chicago Teachers Union.
Yeah, as I mentioned before, when I joined CPS, I joined as a teacher, and it was my role to be of relevance to the students, try to be a teacher, a role model for them. And that's the job of a teacher, to be with the students inside the classroom, inside the school building. And I cannot imagine myself when in 2016, as they strike the union, I cannot imagine myself breaking the promise I had to the students that I would be with them, because we were supposed to practice then. And 3 weeks from then, we won the national championship in chess. So to me, regardless of my condition, as much as if I can do it, then I'll do it for the kids. It's all for the kids. I just want to be able to be relevant somehow in their lives. And that, I think, is important. And to me, being in the classroom is sort of a nourishment spiritually for me to be with my students instead of...
So Mr. Call, besides you, how many other teachers showed up yesterday and how many students?
Well, there were no classes yesterday. It was announced, so I was the only teacher at the school yesterday. But the other staff, the custodians, security, the administration people were there. So I took advantage of the time by organizing my classroom. But I've always been ready to teach. I was always ready to be, because the school building was open for everyone to come. And I think that's what's going to happen still today. I'm hoping that this can be resolved soon for the benefit of the kids. Because it's the kids who are suffering here. It's not anybody else. The kids, and of course the parents, because there are parents who have jobs do, and they they're stuck right now for what to do, because the kids, their kids should be in the school, and the parents are supposed to be working, earning a living. But now this is a different situation where it's not even clear as to when this can be resolved. But I hope that the union will look at it another way, because it's not fair to do a sweeping, you know, a sweeping demand for everybody to stay home. Because right. Even my classroom, I have 82 students so far, total of 82 students. Nobody has COVID. Nobody had COVID. I didn't have COVID. And I don't know of a fellow teacher in that school who has COVID. So I cannot see the point why we should be staying home, or my kids should be deprived of that opportunity for learning when they don't even have COVID. So what's the point? Besides, there's nothing to say that staying home would be more effective. I mean, are we saying that the school is not that safe? We have been observing all the safety measures, all the protocols. And even in my classroom, I've been very observant about that. We follow the protocols. So it also depends on the school.
Right, but here's the bottom line. You're somebody who has cancer, and you're in school. It's sort of, I don't know, it should. Heroic. It probably doesn't. Sure, it's a shame, all of these other adults that are pretending that schools are such vector for sickness and death, when you're there ready to go with obviously a serious underlying condition. But I wanted to also, just since you made this transition from Merle STEM Academy, I mean, again, what you did there is the stuff of movies. I mean, it's the stuff of, you know, Jaime Escalante. And and you just mentioned the state championship that the national championship, excuse me, that your kids won in chess. Do you hear from them? I mean, you were working in Inglewood, which is, you know, one of the most violent and difficult neighborhoods in the city. And I just wonder, you know, if you're able to stay in touch with those kids who you did have such an impact on, positive impact on, and know how they're doing in light of everything going on.
When I transferred, a lot of them, a number of my kids, and even the parents called as to why I transferred. So I tried to explain that it was because of the distance. But I produced champions among kids in Inglewood, and I thought maybe in other schools, and I was invited to be at Ella Flagyang Elementary School too, because they never had the chess program. So I thought I can still help in whatever way I could, and I thought that maybe they should also have that opportunity to have a chess program after school. And also the algebra program, because I also teach algebra. I taught algebra at Earl STEM Elementary. So they never had the algebra program for the elementary or middle school in this current school that I have right now. That's Ella Flagyang Elementary. So I thought I can still be of help also certain other schools, and there are kids who also need help. And I thought with the chess program, the algebra program, I can still be of help whatever way I can.
What's your conversation been with teachers at Ella Flag? They have to know who you are.
I don't know when I meet with them. I hope this can be resolved soon, but I'm hoping that they keep an open mind. And I hope they understand my point. It's a personal choice on my part. But at the same time, I'm not beholden to the union. When I joined CPS, I joined CPS as a teacher. And that's my role, first and foremost, to be a teacher, not to be a union member. And I was a union member before, and I saw that somehow I think it's better for me to be out of the union, because the union right now is more on political maneuvering. They mm-hmm. I mean, a union has to be apolitical. Apolitical. They should not be, supporting candidates or this and this and this. It's,
right. Well, they're the third political party in Chicago. That's for sure.
Yeah.
But I'm glad you didn't keep to them. But what is your plan for tomorrow? Because tomorrow parents are sending their kids to school. Are you ready to welcome your kids back to class?
Oh, I'm excited to meet them. I miss them terribly. I miss my fellow teachers. I miss my students. I miss them. And they have already, the students have already lost more than a year of learning when they had this remote learning for more than a year. And now here's another set of losses. So what will come out with their kids? I mean, they keep on being at home. It doesn't make sense. I mean, it doesn't really make sense for a person to be at home and on the conclusion that there will be no COVID or there will be, it's safer. It doesn't make sense. It's all about how you follow the safety protocols. And my classroom, our school has been following my classroom and the school. They have been following the safety protocols. It's just a matter of how you do things correctly and with safety in your mind.
He is Joseph Ocal, formerly of Earl STEM Elementary School in Inglewood, where he taught math and started a chess club. Now he's at Ella Flagg Young School, which is what, North Austin, Joe?
It's in Parkside, 1434 North
yeah.
Parkside.
Yeah.
It's also a school that it's even a bigger population than Earl STEM. That's a bigger population, but they never had a chess program, so I thought I could make chess also something for them.
It's wonderful what you've done and what you're continuing to do. Good luck at Ella Flagg Young and to your kids, and stay well. You're a good dude, and you're an inspiration, I think, to a lot of people in Chicago and now around the country, and that's a good thing.
Good son. Thank you, Amy.
All right,
thank you for giving me this opportunity to speak in your program.
Yeah, and God bless you, and we hope you... beat this cancer. So thank you so much for joining us this morning. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So President Biden is going to deliver remarks on this anniversary of January 6th on the topic of the former president, to be sure, and those who laid siege on the Capitol on January 6th of last year.
Even WGN last night, they're like the deadly attacks on the Capitol.
Uh-huh.
Sitnik did not die. Officer Sitnik did not die because of the attack on the Capitol. But they can't figure that out yet.
A White House spokes being Jen Psaki previewing the president's comments.
And I think the role of the former president in this, the role and unfortunately the silence and the complacency of a number of far too many, not every, but far too many member of the Republican Party in the time since then in perpetuating the big lie has stuck with him as well. So I would say that, of course, he's involved in the writing of any major speech he gives in feedback and conveying whether it's meeting the moment of what he wants to say. But certainly tomorrow, the significance of it is something that he feels personally about.
No question. I'm sure he does. The Capitol Hill police chief, the new Capitol Hill police chief, Tom Manger, was on the Hill yesterday in a Senate committee hearing. And Senator Ted Cruz had this to say in the run-up to his interaction with the Capitol Hill police chief, this to say about 1/6 and the Capitol Hill police.
Thank you for your service. And I want to start by thanking the
heroic service of the men and women who serve alongside you. We are approaching a solemn anniversary this week, and it is an anniversary of a violent terrorist attack on the Capitol, where we saw the men and women of law enforcement demonstrate incredible courage, incredible bravery, risk their lives to defend the men and women who serve in this Capitol.
A terrorist attack? Is that what it was? That's an interesting characterization by Ted Cruz. I don't know that you can make out a terrorist attack. That implies planning when the evidence, as far as I understand it to this point, suggests more of a rally that turned into a bit of a riot, a desecration that occurred, not an insurrection. It's interesting, Cruz, I think, displaying his worst tendencies to be political and obsequious in advance of his own sort of political agenda as he looks past 2022 to 2024, perhaps.
Yeah. He's going to run for president.
Also, his comments there at the outset versus what he got back from the police chief, Tom Manger. He asked this question.
What could have been done to better secure the Capitol to stop the riot outside and prevent them from penetrating as far as they did?
I thought it was a terrorist attack. Now it's a riot. I thought the Capitol Police performed uniformly, courageously, and heroically. So what could have been done better to prevent? There was a failure of policing and congressional leadership. This we know. Here's what Tom Manger said, to his credit, owning those failures.
So I think that clearly documented intelligence failures. There were leadership failures within the Capitol Police Department. If folks had, if the intelligence had been acted on the way it should have been, and we would have had enough people here, I think it would have been a different story. And that one of the things that we have, one of the changes that we put into place is that with a few phone calls, I can get double or triple the number of police officers we have trained, equipped police officers here to assist us in our responsibilities to protect the Capitol and protect the members of Congress. So when you look at the recommendations, when you look at what happened, we didn't have the people, we didn't act on the intelligence, and we just weren't prepared the way we should have been. And that's going to change. That has changed, and the next time that we're tested, we will not be making those same mistakes.
Now, those failures don't in any way exonerate people who broke the law, but they do provide more of a complete picture of what happened and why it happened on January 6th for people who are interested to actually try to understand it, as opposed to just use it to advance their political agenda, as you see being done by the 1-6 Commission, that Star Chamber, and the show trial they're set to put on. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Julie Kelly, senior contributor for American Greatness, amgreatness.com. Author of the book Disloyal Opposition, How the Never Trump Right Tried and Failed to Take Down the President. Julie, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for getting my blood pressure up already. Appreciate that.
Well, I mean, I appreciate the Capitol Police Chief pointing up lessons learned from what happened. And that, of course, then goes back to say, well, who knew what when? What were the decisions made such that there weren't the resources at the Capitol that should have been at the Capitol per the intelligence that was provided ostensibly to congressional leaders prior to January 6th? And why was the offer of 10,000 National Guardsmen that President Trump apparently made rebuffed? Those seem to be questions that are still a bit hazy in terms of answers.
Well, I'll tell you why they're hazy, and I actually have a new book out this week, January 6th, How the Democrats Are Using the Capitol Protest to Launch a Domestic War on Terror Against the Political Right, and that will help answer some of the questions. Both Ted Cruz and the Capitol Police Tom Major are lying about what happened on January 6th. Of course, it was not a terror attack. Ted Cruz is rightfully, justifiably getting roasted by everyone for mimicking the words of Christopher Wray, which the FBI officially designated that 4-hour disturbance as an act of domestic terror. They are describing January 6th defendants as domestic terrorists in court. But Capitol Police also overlooked the fact that one of their officers shot and killed an unarmed woman at near point blank range inside the building. I don't know why Ted Cruz didn't mention that. Capitol Police also spent a good portion of the afternoon side by side with DC Metro, who were clad in riot gear from top to bottom, assaulting protesters outside the building. Now, we know this because there's plenty of video. This is also why they want to keep the surveillance video, 14,000 hours of it, concealed from the public. But it is slowly being released under discovery as these trials now are finally being scheduled. And you see Capitol Police also in riot gear throwing explosive devices at the crowd with DC Metro, dousing people with tear gas. Now, these are people outside on the Capitol grounds. These are not people even trying to get into the building. This happened at about 1:15 that day. So some of the criminals, actually, and this may sound be hard for people to hear, are police officers, D.C. Metro, Capitol Police, which is why Nancy Pelosi and Muriel Bowser did not want 10,000 National Guardsmen helping to secure the Capitol. These two police forces, under the thumb of Muriel Bowser and Nancy Pelosi, had their marching orders, which was to attack this crowd, provoke a lot of the confrontations that you saw between protesters. One shot and killed a woman. Another one probably contributed to the death of another woman, Roseanne Boylan. And there are scenes of police brutality inside the Lower West Tunnel Terrace, where police officers are beating, punching, and stomping women trapped inside that tunnel. So the idea that law enforcement was the good guys that day, for Ted Cruz to say it and for Capitol Police to act that way, is completely inimical to the evidence that we now have.
Yeah, but on the other side of the Capitol, I mean, there's different things going on where police officers were being stomped, and you can't deny that hundreds of them were injured.
Well, I don't know. I haven't seen any reports. U.S. Capitol Police refused to release reports. They refused to release the names of officers who allegedly have been injured in court documents. They only use initials. They are concealing any names and any evidence of a list of officers who were injured. Now, certainly we know some officers were injured, and we know that there were protesters who acted badly. But to portray this as one-sided is not true, and it's not fair to the defendants, who in some cases were defending themselves and defending others from being attacked by these police officers that day. This is why they didn't want additional security. It is not a question of a failure of intelligence. It was by design by Democrats like Nancy Pelosi and Muriel Bowser. Otherwise,
well, and the Democrats need this. I mean, look what they're doing today. Every cable station is live
from
the Capitol, and then the president and the vice president are going to speak there. The Democrats, if they don't have this, they have nothing.
That's right. And let me also point out the Newsweek article this week. We know, contrary to what Ted Cruz has just said, the Capitol Police and everyone else, that contrary to the idea there were not enough people there to help defend the Capitol, there were hundreds of FBI elite forces on the ground early that day, infiltrating the crowd. They were at the Capitol grounds, and they were inside the Capitol at the moment of the first breach, which happened about 2:15 that day. So what were these FBI agents doing? These are elite forces, hostage rescue teams, SWAT teams. They had been stationed at Quantico the weekend before. The FBI and DOJ, Acting Attorney General Jeffrey Rosen, were fully aware of alleged intelligence and possibility of violence. So what were those hundreds of FBI agents doing if they weren't protecting the Capitol? So we have several different narratives that don't make sense as they try to run together and bolster this groupthink about an armed insurrection by Trump supporters.
Well, there's some things here. First, that, you know, what was happening outside on public grounds versus what was happening inside, including with the shooting death of the woman in question. I mean, those are different things because the people inside had broken the law and they shouldn't have been
right
there. In addition to the people outside, I mean, I want to understand what you're saying. Are you saying that the police instigated the confrontation with protesters, that the melee that occurred was the police were the first movers and not some of those rally goers that turned into rioters, the instigators?
So there were two, there were a few different things happening because the Capitol building, as you know, was so large. So there was a group right before 1 o'clock that breached the initial lines right far outside of the Capitol building. And that is where you see a man named Ray Epps, who is now a suspected FBI asset, who still has not been charged almost a year later, whisper in the ear of someone who then breaches that police line. And Proud Boys run up the stairs and they advance towards the Capitol and they're trying to get near the Capitol. But that is going on as Trump's speech is still happening. So you have that initial group. The Proud Boys, we also know, are infiltrated with FBI informants at that point. So you have that first breach. But the people who are coming from Trump's speech then, walking towards the Capitol, when they start arriving, his speech ends shortly after 1 o'clock. When they start arriving, they don't know what had happened beforehand. But people have told me, and I talk about it in my book, and there's plenty of witness accounts of this in court documents, that as they're approaching, they can see smoke from these flashbangs and explosive devices. And as they start approaching, they see people being attacked who are coming from the speech, not anybody who's trying to breach the building or get closer to the building. And this group of police starts throwing these devices into crowds of peaceful people. These are people standing outside singing, waving flags. And there's some speculation that another man, the first man who died, there were four people who died that day. Brian Sicknick was not one of them. They were all Trump supporters. Died after one of these flashbangs hit the ground, and he had a heart attack after this flashbang. So this is all evidence. This is not imaginary. And this is why you see Democrats now suddenly so desperate to embrace Capitol Police and law enforcement as heroes after demeaning them for years, especially in the summer of 2020, because they were the ones who, for the most part, instigated and provoked a lot of the confrontations that you saw that day. And I have seen the surveillance video and seen what police did. Now, you can break the law. People who went into the building, there were hundreds who entered the building while Capitol Police were standing right there. There were also people who unlawfully went into the building. You still should not have federal officers shoot at them. You still should not have officers beat them or punch them or kick them. I mean, this happens all the time. People going into government buildings where they're not supposed to be.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, the problem is trying to unpack all of this when you have, as I said, this melee occurring across an expansive space and you don't have full context. But you know some people broke the law. You know police responded. The police responded peacefully to it, at least from a lot of the video that's been made publicly available to some of those that breached the Capitol. And then there were other incidents where there's a fight going on. And, yeah, you don't know who instigated it, but you know that this is the police are trying to set up a defensive line. Apparently without enough personnel there, or at least parts of the perimeter. And they're apparently, they look like they're being confronted by some people that are behaving unlawfully. And so, I mean,
that's what it looks like. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, across hundreds of people and hundreds of police officers, expansive space, I don't know either, but I mean, there certainly were bad actors that were civilians that broke the law and that demanded a police response. And then it seems to me that it's sort of case specific or position specific in terms of whether the response by police was justified or not.
Well, I think that it's much broader than that. And I think that supports why they did not want National Guardsmen there. Now,
with the second of National Guardsmen. So, you know, Mitch McConnell, as the president of the Senate Majority Leader, he's got a sergeant at arms. I mean, if this was essentially, you're insinuating, was like a conspiracy to not have enough people there or to have people there that would instigate a riot and lead to all this, then is Mitch McConnell a part of it, too? He's ostensibly, and his sergeant at arms is getting the same information that Pelosi and her sergeant at arms is getting in the House.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't use the word conspiracy. I think it was an operation. And so he might have been, his staff might have been. Maybe they did not believe that it was going to get violent, because why were there so many past Trump rallies, including Stop the Steal rallies in November and December, that never got violent, except for BLM and Antifa, who attacked people leaving the White House in September? Stop the Steal Trump supporters in November, where we saw video of them being attacked. Why suddenly did this become so violent? The idea, though, that this was just one-sided is not supported by the evidence. That's what I'm trying to explain. Mm-hmm. Muriel Bowser released a press release on January 5th explicitly saying, I'm declining offers of additional help from National Guardsmen.
Right.
We want 300 to help with traffic and closing down streets. Why did they shut down then the either Pennsylvania or Constitution between the Ellipse and getting to Capitol Hill? Those streets weren't shut down. Most of the people who arrived from Trump's speech between 1:30 and 2 o'clock, by the time they got there, they have said, we had no idea Capitol grounds had been restricted access.
Well, Julia,
charged for trespassing for being on grounds that they didn't even know had been shut off to the public.
No.
So when you're talking about unanswered questions or things that don't make sense and line up, this is what I'm trying to explain. It is not as cut and dry as law enforcement wasn't prepared. They were attacked. They were trying to do their best to defend the Capitol or lawmakers.
Well, and then you have people like Jenna Ryan. She's 51. She was in the Capitol for 2 minutes and 18 seconds, didn't touch anything, just walked in and walked out, and she's going to spend 60 days in jail.
Well, yeah, we can't get into
to that
the,
right now,
the
but I mean, that's a ludicrous.
Julie Kelly, senior contributor for American Greatness, amgreatness.com, author of Disloyal Opposition, and the new book, Julie, is what?
January 6th.
All right, Julie, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, and she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. All right, no one is fully vaccinated. They just are or are not up to date. And also, so just again, updating your glossary of terms the COVIDian era. In addition to that, with respect to the reduction in the time in the isolation chamber, if you're infected, from 10 days to 5 days, Jen Psaki, White House spokesman, was queried about that.
Yeah.
Is this political or is this based on science and data? And she said this.
The CDC is absolutely led by data and science. And, you know, again, if they hadn't changed their recommendations over the course of time, schools would probably be closed across the country, right? They, of course, are continuing to address, as they have for the past year plus, steps that need to be taken in order to protect the American people.
She said they're driven by science and data, and then she essentially said they make decisions based on political considerations like schools being open. So
right.
Which is it?
They don't want social disturbances or disruptions, as they call it.
What people are willing to do is how Rolensky explained it before the first of the year. Also, something else, the tests, the antigen tests to take before you come out of the isolation chamber, they are useful or they're not useful? Well, they're both. We don't know. Last week, in an NBC interview, Walensky said the information provided by an antigen test will not be useful. Will not be useful. Now the CDC is saying, quoting the CDC's website, if an individual has access to a test and wants to test, the best approach is to use an antigen test toward the end of the five-day isolation period. Okay. Collect the test sample only if you are fever-free for 24 hours without the use of fever-reducing medication and your other symptoms have improved. If your test result is positive, you should continue to isolate until day 10. If your test result is negative, you can end isolation, but continue to wear a well-fitting mask around others at home and in public until day 10. Got
can
all that?
Can it be cotton?
So it's not useful last week. It is useful if you test negative 5 days. If you test positive on the fifth day, go to 10 days. And that's only if you have access to a test and you want to test.
My head is spinning, Dan.
No, it's completely clear, straightforward, obviously driven by science and data, just like Jen Psaki said. Okay, sure. For more on this, perhaps providing some clarity that we can't seem to get from the Biden spokesbeings or the Centers for Control, please be joined by our friend, Dr. Marty Makary again, Professor Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and Bloomberg School of Public Health, Chief Medical Advisor to Sesame Care, and the author of the award-winning The Price We Pay, What Broke American Healthcare and How to Fix It. Dr. Makary, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan and Amy.
So are antigen tests useful or are not useful or both?
So let me tell you, don't fall for this distraction. This sort of artificial manufactured debate about which shoddy test you should use at the end of a quarantine period, the real issue is, why are we quarantining at all? Why are we quarantining immune people from other immune people? This is where we have been bamboozled. There's no need to quarantine unless you're otherwise going to be around somebody vulnerable. We've got to just get back to common sense, which means, look, if you've been exposed, be careful or wear a mask. If you're around someone vulnerable, be careful or stay a distance. And if you're sick, stay home. That should be our guidance, not, you know, which shoddy test we should be using. We know the antigen tests are not perfect, and they have a low sensitivity when you don't have symptoms. So, you know, the sensitivity is downwards of 50%. So, and then they're saying, well, maybe you want to get a second one just to be sure. Well, we only have a limited supply of tests. And so we've created this black market. They've put out these, this guidance to say, test the hell out of everybody. And we only have 80 million tests in the market. So, I mean, they're creating price gouging in a black market.
But healthy people are testing, excuse me, and taking tests away from people who are sick who need to get tested. And there's other people that are stockpiling tests that are healthy because Dr. Fauci and Walensky and our Dr. Awardi here in Chicago said even if you're vaccinated and you're going to be with family members, get a test 3 days before and then the day of the event, and then you can go to the event. And now our cases are skyrocketing because everybody and their mother has gotten tested.
Look, we could get a test before breakfast, at lunch, before dinner, after dinner, before you go to bed, every day. But the reality is we have a scarce supply, and this country has never realized that we've got a ration and we've got to do it wisely, which means save the tests for nursing home staff. Save the tests for those who are around somebody with immunosuppression or those who are in the hospital where we got to be careful. We cannot be using these tests on the lowest risk people on planet Earth, which are testing students twice a week. That's what we see at some of these colleges.
Well, that's the only way they can get back in the classroom, and their adaptive pauses is what they're is the edicts that are being imposed.
Well, they've created the problem that they are there to fix. This is a manufactured crisis. They are both the arsonist and the firefighter. It's like, let's go back to the very barrier that they've created.
Well, I wanted to ask you about this dangerous push to give boosters to teens, because both the CDC and FDA experts say the plan was ill-advised, so the agency just cut them out of the decision process. Is that true?
Yeah, it's really, really sad, Amy. So the experts out there, if you really listen to them, and I'm not talking about the government doctors or the CNN doctors. I'm talking about the real vaccinology experts. When you talk to them and those who have been on this expert panel of the FDA, they have significant concerns about boosting young, healthy people because the risk of someone under age 30 dying of COVID with just a primary vaccine series and no booster is zero. So you cannot lower the number zero any further with a booster. And so what the FDA is, they knew that these experts were opposed to boosters. They knew these experts had concerns about myocarditis, which is as high as 1 in 1,800 young men after the second dose of the vaccine. And so the FDA said, you know what, we'll just do a second push internally, and we're going to not convene the experts and just ream it through. Remember, this is the very issue why two top FDA officials quit in protest over political pressure. And I'm talking top officials. One of them, longstanding head of the FDA Vaccine Center, They quit over this very issue, which was boosters in young, healthy people.
Well, but if you don't get boosted, then you're not up to date. And if you're not up to date, then at some point you can't participate in civil society. One of the top docs in the UK, who I don't believe claims he is science the way that Louis Fauci the 14th does here, said this idea of booster forever boosters is impractical. It's not workable. But that doesn't seem to be the attitude of those government and CNN doctors that we mostly hear from.
That's right. We hear from a very small sliver of physicians. And remember, the medical community has been susceptible to groupthink. And when I talk to doctors around the country, they're not on board with what they hear coming out of, you know, Dr. Fauci and the government ignoring natural immunity, pushing boosters in young, healthy people. They're not on board with this. We hear from a very skewed set of opinions, and that groupthink has burnt us several times before. I mean, just think about surface transmission, pour 50 gallons of alcohol in your grocery bags, the barbaric practice of not allowing people to visit their loved ones to say goodbye when they died. And that was cruel. All the, you know, medical establishment were complicit in that. So the groupthink, you know, ignoring natural immunity, the groupthink has hurt us badly, and it's the same now with boosters. Unfortunately, colleges and universities are just jumping on. They're supposed to be intelligent, but they're saying we're going to require boosters. If you look at the UK data, 10 weeks after the booster, the efficacy went down to 35%. So what are we going to do, boost people every 3 months or every Monday morning when they show up at work?
Well, they moved it from 6 months to 5 months yesterday that it's okay now. But I wanted to ask you about therapeutics. What's the deal? Why can't doctors write prescriptions for hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin, especially in big cities, democratic cities like Chicago?
Well, in my opinion, hydroxy and ivermectin don't have any activity against the virus. That's my personal opinion of reviewing the literature. So what we've seen is a massive backlash. Now, remember, a lot of doctors took hydroxy early on because everyone was hopeful. You know, the FDA gave an EUA, an authorization for hydroxy for COVID, because everyone was hopeful. The data didn't support it. So what you saw by the medical establishment and the government is a backlash against all therapeutics. Fluvoxamine, for example, is an antidepressant, reduces COVID death by 91%, solid randomized control trial data, no data to the controversy, no controversy around it, not like ivermectin and hydroxy. And yet Fauci's never said the word fluvoxamine once. It's on the Johns Hopkins COVID information webpage. It's on the Washington University School of Medicine COVID information webpage. They've never talked about fluvoxamine. They barely talk about Paxlovid, Pfizer's drug that cut COVID deaths to zero. They never talk about obesity or the underlying causes. They have such a skewed, myopic focus on vaccines. They got to recognize it's one tool. It's probably our best tool, but we've got amazing therapeutics such that no one should be dying of COVID right now.
Well, speaking of Paxlovid, Biden mentioned he put an order in for 20 million doses of Paxlovid to Pfizer. He mentioned that in his Pandemic of the Unvaccinated pro forma speech on Tuesday. So if we've got Paxlovid coming online and it is this game changer that it's been described and as you just described, then why does everybody have to get vaccinated and boosted in perpetuity if I get sick and I can take a pill, a therapeutic that, you know, that cures me?
Well, that's a good point, Dan. So the new therapeutics that cut COVID deaths to practically zero render mandates obsolete. And they don't want to talk about that, right? If I told you, hey, jumping out of an airplane, you need a parachute. You're required. We're going to mandate parachutes.
We are?
Okay.
Oh, my gosh.
But what if you're jumping 10 feet out of a slow-moving airplane into an ocean? Well, maybe it's not that critical if you're jumping 10 feet. It renders the parachute mandate obsolete, and that's what they haven't recognized.
And just since we're beset by this in Chicago with the Chicago Teachers Union shutting down the school system, you wrote this piece over at Barry Weiss's Substack the other day. I mentioned a bit yesterday in our conversations on the topic. about, and you just were referencing earlier about what colleges are doing, but it's not just colleges. It's K through 12 school districts around the country, not a ton of them, but some big ones and some other bigger ones that are trying to do the same thing that Chicago did, places like New York and San Francisco. Just to repeat, is there any basis to keep the schools closed? Is there any enhanced safety measure that should be required to reopen schools in person?
Well, all the data says they must be open because kids are getting harmed from the closure. So if you want to hurt kids, you keep the schools closed. 31% of U.S. parents say their child's mental health is much worse. And I think anyone with kids can understand that to be the case. I mean, girls are trying to commit suicide at a rate of 51% higher than they were pre-pandemic. We've got to wake up. The data are clear on schools. It is safer to keep the schools open than it is to have them closed. But right now, you know, they'll look for any excuse to close the schools. If the curtain doesn't work in one of the rooms, they will close the schools right now.
Oh, yeah. In Chicago, you have a better chance of getting shot than dying from COVID or even getting COVID. I mean, seven in the past two and a half years have died from COVID in the city. And just this year alone, 149 were shot.
So, Doctor, on the booster, since you were talking about that, and some schools are mandating it, and more probably will, if there's more risk to illness, to an adverse outcome from the booster than there is from COVID, but your school is mandating it, what's your advice and counsel to parents? You know, just fall in line and path of least resistance, and it probably won't do any damage to your kid getting boosted, or
no.
Or find another school.
Look, we don't live in North Korea. We don't just have to do what the government tells us. We can push back, and we need to demand data. As I described in this Barry Weiss piece on school policies, we've got to push back against the dogma. Where's the data? So the data are clear that after a booster, young men have a rate of heart inflammation. That's not a good thing. Heart inflammation, one in 1,800 young men. So what do we just blow that off? One 22-year-old died from that heart inflammation in a study in the New England Journal of about 136 people with that condition. Sure, most of them are mild, but we're playing with fire because we're not going to lower COVID deaths any further because the rate's already zero among people with a primary vaccine series. And in Germany, they just did a study that no person 5 through 17 has ever died of COVID if they've been healthy without any vaccination in that country. So let's stop blaming children for a problem that's really an adult problem. And adults are exerting an imbalance of power. It's an abuse of power against the defenseless, and it's wrong.
Dr. Marty Makary, professor at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and Bloomberg School of Public Health, chief medical advisor to Sesame Care and author of the award-winning The Price We Pay, What Broke American Healthcare and How to Fix It. Dr. Makary, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Good to be with you guys. Thanks.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is the morning show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's morning answer on AM 560. The answer. This is Chicago's morning answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Zach Kriegman had a educational background that made him an ideal data scientist at Reuters. Bachelor's in econ from Michigan, a law degree from Harvard, years of experience with high-tech startups, White Shoe Law Firm, econometrics research consultancy. He then spent 6 years at Reuters, an international media organization you may have heard, spearheading the company's efforts in the AI machine learning space, as well as advanced software engineering. He was the director of data science, leading a team tasked with implementing deep learning throughout the organization. But Well, certainly an educated man and apparently a talented one.
What happened to him? Cancel culture?
A chain of events would turn the 44-year-old data scientist's life upside down by June of 2020 as riots raged across the country, Krikun would be locked out of Raider servers, denounced by his colleagues, fired by email. What was his offense? He criticized Black Lives Matter. He criticized Black Lives Matter in the company's internal communication forums. And he said he was driven by what he called a moral obligation to speak out. Krikun refused to celebrate unquestioningly the BLM narrative and his company's diversity and inclusion programming. He argued that Reuters was exhibiting significant bias in the newsroom. Oh, really?
How'd you pick up on that?
And that the ongoing BLM protests, riots, and calls to defund the police would wreak havoc on minority communities. He refused to bend the knee to the DIE personnel within Reuters. So he gone. And while calls for people to stand up and speak out continue from perches like ours and from many other people that believe in a peaceful pluralistic society and the rights enshrined in the Constitution, there's real reason why people don't speak out. And how do you create an environment now, given where we're at, where people feel comfortable speaking out if they otherwise can't risk losing their job or just are too risk averse to speak out if their job is on the line, if their kids' grades in school or entrance to a particular school is on the line? It's a bit of a conundrum. To help us try to address that conundrum, we're pleased to be joined by Guy Shepherd, who is the publisher of an outpost called Planned Man, and recently made sort of a counterintuitive call to arms, to big tech, in furtherance of this effort to reestablish people's rights to freely express themselves. Guy, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. I mean, I enjoyed your piece. The keep our heads down, shut up, eat me last approach will not end well. And I agree with that. But you think that enlisting, making a moral appeal to our big tech overlords is the way we're going to get back to a place where people like that that data scientist at Reuters can speak freely and not be canned for doing so?
Well, I think it's important to kind of remind them of their original pitch books that they came public with. You know, big tech came up with this distinction between us versus them, and they were on the side of us, really leveling the distinctions and the barriers to free speech. But, you know, 15 years later, you wouldn't recognize them by their pitch books. And what I'm trying to do is remind them of, you know, the need to kind of be, particularly if you're going to be governed by Section 230 and not be the New York Times, that they should see themselves as really a free speech utility. And, you know, and just as a utility doesn't make distinctions based on partisan persuasion, right, on one's color, creed, or, you know, sexual persuasion, I don't think they should be making these distinctions. I think the real thing that has made things worse is that, you know, big tech is favoring, you know, a flavor of them. And I think that it's in their interest, long-term interest, not to do so, because I think you see what's happening. You know, it seems that, you know, people don't mind the equal application of a rule, but the rules aren't being equally applied, right? You know, so, you know, my moment in time for me was when the Twitter moms went after Winston Marshall. You know, Winston Marshall is a kind, you know, soft-spoken gentleman, a banjo player from Mumford & Sons, and his sins and crime against humanity was that he retweeted a New York Times bestseller that was critical of Antifa, you know? And it's like, so you retweet a New York Times bestseller, and then all of a sudden, you know, you're attacked by the Twitter mobs calling you a fascist, because I think the logic of our times is completely, you know, turned upside down.
You know, oh, yeah.
Well, you know, to be against Antifa makes you pro-fascist instead of what is really true, that you're probably anti-Maoist, right? And you probably don't like fascists either. You know, so, you know, we're having a speech where it's like to be critical of people who really wrap themselves in like an ideological flavor that's favorable to kind of a mainstream, they get to act in a manner that's very dangerous. And I think we need to kind of stand up in defense of it, because I think what really does happen is, like, everybody sees people get attacked and they're happy that it's not them. But it, mm-hmm. like when a banjo player from Mumford and Son can kind of, you know, feel the need to separate himself for his band, you know, from his band for his sake and theirs, I think Houston, we have a problem. Or Chicago, we have a problem.
And it's not like he authored the tweet or liked the tweet. He just retweeted the tweet. And that's what got him in trouble. And that's happening to other people we know. So basically, though, on what day did the First Amendment die?
Well, I mean, it's always hard to tell. So every movement needs a moment in time where people say enough's enough. You know, I just thought, you know, what happened to Winston Marshall was such an obvious example of something, you know, that no one could defend. It was a right thing to happen. You know, once upon a time, I mean, I would have never written this piece if the ACLU was doing its job. You know, I'm not here to kind of, and this is, I mean, you said it was counterintuitive. I'm not here to make an argument, you know, in defense of a party. I'm here to make an argument in defense of really the preconditions of really a healthy politics. And I think we've lost that. And I think, you know, usually the ACLU, when they would stand up and fight for things, they would always defend the extreme, right? Well, the problem is it's hard to defend an extreme, right? And that was their value over time. But I don't think defending Winston is an extreme. I think he was an example for me, a mainstream example of a person who pretty much just exercised what he thought was, like, you know, his God-given right, you know, on this new medium of Twitter to make a point, and then he was attacked for it. And what I like about what he did, and I think it's, you know, gets to this point where what makes this guy and what makes his moment a moment in time that we should reflect on, is that, you know, once he kind of tried to satiate the mob, you know, they weren't happy, but more importantly, he wasn't happy himself. He felt like he compromised himself. And what he did was, after reflection prayer, he separated himself from his band. And he wrote, he wrote a piece, a declaration of it. You can find a link to it from our site, planman.com. But he pretty much kind of said, it's like, you know, quoting Solzhenitsyn, right? And other kind of people like Vaclav Havel. It's like, you know, we cannot live by lies. By allowing people to actually, you know, anti-fascist or Maoist to control the conversation, right, and not stand up to it. That's how Orwell, you know, opens its door, you know, in this kind of idiocratic politics I think we're trending to, which I don't think anybody has an interest in.
Yeah, I mean, again, and so stipulated, and there's so many examples of the Mumford & Sons guy. I mean, they're legion at this point. But if you look at what the response has been from these big tech companies that exercise so much control over the discourse, the only entity that I've seen get them to change their behavior has been the Chinese communists, because they want access to the market. So this doesn't seem to be a group at the upper echelons of these companies that is persuaded by a moral appeal, despite all of their, you know, blathering about values and so forth. The only thing they understand, being those they decry, is a cost being imposed. And the Chinese communists can impose a cost by blocking them from that huge market. The question is, what kind of cost can we impose if, you know, your moral appeal falls on deaf ears once again?
Well, I mean, outside of a moral appeal, I mean, I think there was just the recognition that, I think, if big tech was forced to choose whether or not they were going to, you know, be a partisan outlet, partisan outlet like the New York Times or a utility like AT&T, they'd make the binary choice and choose the utility model. I mean, they presently find themselves in a circumstance where, you know, they can, you know, eat their cake and have it too. Right. You know, it's understandable why they give in to the Chinese, because it's for profit. And in a certain sense, it's understandable why they gave in to this they stopped defending us, you know, a pluribus of all, and went in and started kind of, you know, favoring a flavor of them for two reasons. One is they were incentivized to do it, and, you know, by outside forces, be it, you know, other media, New York Times and other places, but also it was an easy thing to ask them to do because it really is, you know, they said, exercise your values as an owner of this company, right? And I think that has put them in a circumstance that has contributed to this this moment in time we're in. But I do think if they really had people that were helping them game this out, they would kind of see that they're not on a, you know, they're not on a good path, right? You know, as you said, there it's possible that it's like people will make a choice, like, so if they're forced, if they, you know, if 230 protections is taken away, and then the New York Times, their business model gets hit, right? But I also think that, you know, I do think appealing to principles is an important thing. You know, it's like, I do think people don't like hypocrisy. And I think if you hold up their, you know, like, do not, you know, be not evil or whatever Google's, you know, kind of mantra was when they came out, and you kind of look at the behavior of these companies, they, you know, they look a little creepy. And I think that the American people or American political discourse would be benefited from, you know, kind of returning to that idea that, you know, they favor a pluribus of us over them. And, you know, and they don't pick winners and losers, right? They actually let the free market of, like, debate and exchange kind of carry the day. Because I only think the solution of to the problems of free speech is more free speech.
He is Guy Shepherd, publisher of the Planned Man outlet, PlannedMan.com. Guy, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, on this anniversary of the rioting that occurred at the Capitol on January 6th. There's a lot of talk about saving our democracy, preserving our democracy. You're hearing from both Biden and Harris today.
And I got to tell you, I watched Biden during the break here, and he still thinks that Officer Sitnik, and he's still claiming that Officer Sitnik died a day after the riots because of what happened. How is he lying to American people like that? We know what caused his death. He had a stroke the day after. He did not get hit in the head with a fire extinguisher. They're just, you know, perpetuating these lies, and I can't even watch it anymore.
The D.C. press corps is making a lot of noise over this Washington Post University of Maryland poll, which finds that 34% of Americans believe violence can be justified against the government. And the way that it, number is being reported, of course, is disingenuous. What else would you expect? It's meant to suggest that 34% of Americans believe that we should overthrow the government. 34% of Americans believe that violence is a way to settle political disputes. And that's not at all what the actual poll asked. The actual poll. The actual poll asked, do you think it is ever justified for citizens to take violent action against the government, or is it never justified? It wasn't a question about January 6th, whether January 6th was justified. Oh. And you understand, if you've listened to the show, our position from January 7th of last year forward, which there was no justification for the violence that occurred, the rioting that occurred, the lawlessness that occurred. But the question, do you think it is ever justified for citizens to take violent action against the government, or is it never justified? Well, to say that it's never justified is to misunderstand the founding of the country. It's also to misunderstand what Americans are saying. If you look into the polling a little bit more deeply, as David Harsanyi did over at National Review, participants were asked to provide instances where violence against the state would be justified. Government violates or takes away rights or freedoms/oppresses people. Government no longer a democracy becomes a dictatorship. Coup, military takes over. Government violates constitution. Government abuses power slash tyranny. Government is violent against citizens slash safety is at risk. So there was no indication from those surveyed consistent with the perception that is being promulgated by the D.C. press corps recklessly, inciting people, gaslighting people, really, to believe that our democracy is imperiled in perpetuity by those few hundred people on January 6th of last year who broke the law, unless we pass the Democrat socialist legislative agenda in D.C., like federalizing elections. Unless we do Patriot Act 2.0, or I guess at this point 3.0, in response to what happened last year, which is exactly what Benny Thompson, the chairman of the House committee, House January 6th Commission, has suggested will be one of the work product, part of the work product of this commission. In addition, of course, to keeping open-minded the possibility of a criminal referral to the Justice Department on President Trump or others, which exceeds their constitutional power, speaking of the Constitution. For more on this topic of extremism and what imperils our democracy, perhaps it's those who spend so much time talking about how they're going to save it for us. We're pleased to be joined by Robert Pape, professor of poli-sci at the University of Chicago, specializing in international security affairs, and director of the Chicago Project on Security and Threats. Professor Pape, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, sure. Thanks for having me on.
What about that? I know you've done your own independent survey work, but what about that Washington Post survey and how it is being misunderstood because of the misreporting?
So what's happening, I think your listeners are picking up that they ask very broad questions and unrealistic questions, like, are Nazis going to take over the government? So when you ask those kind of broad questions or unrealistic questions, you leave it open to a wide range of interpretation.
Right.
And so you can interpret it one way, your listeners can interpret another, the headline writer of the Post can interpret it a different way. And that's why when you do surveys in general, you want to ask much more precise questions. And that is what we've done at the University of Chicago. So we've conducted multiple nationally representative surveys, and we found that the equivalent of 21 million adults, that's 8% of all adults, agree on two beliefs. One is that Joe Biden is an illegitimate president, and two, that the use of force to restore Donald Trump to the presidency is justified.
Mm-hmm.
We've done them multiple times. We've increased the N, we've stress tested this. And the fact of the matter is what we see in our summer and our fall surveys is really powerful evidence that there is a continuing ongoing insurrectionist movement in the United States. 2 million of those 21 million report having attended a protest in the last 12 months. So this isn't just a set of latent beliefs. This group is active. 4 million have prior military service. 8 million of the 21 million own guns. This is 6 million of the 21 million support militia groups like the Oath Keepers or extremist groups like the Proud Boys. 1 million are either a member of those groups or know someone who is. So what we're seeing is a disturbingly large and dangerous and active insurrectionist movement in the country. And that's something we have to be very concerned about as we go forward.
How does that compare with the survey research you did after the 2016 election in terms of the number of people who thought Donald Trump was an illegitimate president and the number of people who participated in protests against Donald Trump and what that means in terms of the level of violent extremism of an insurrectionist movement that was afoot after 2016 when Hillary Clinton said that Putin defeated him.
And they had a huge protest on the Capitol. Remember that? Hundreds of thousands of people showed up.
Yeah. So the number one thing to say is the difference is violent. So both with respect to what we see in the polls. So this isn't just saying Biden is illegitimate, which you could say, well, isn't that similar to what happened with Trump? Yes, absolutely. Take that point. But the difference is violence. is violence justified to restore Trump to the presidency? That's a big deal. And, of course, when we talk about hundreds of thousands showing up to protest Trump's presidency, there's no storming of the Capitol. There's no breaking into the White House. There's no storming of the Supreme Court. There's no actually effort to stop President Trump from becoming president. What happened on January 6th was not just people sort of protesting or kind of walking, you know, through the halls of Congress on some random day. This was an effort to prevent a transfer of power from one president to another.
Except the FBI disagrees with you. Except there's no evidence. Professor,
why do you say that?
Why do I say that? Is because the FBI has said to this point they have no evidence of any conspiracy afoot. In point of fact, as the Wall Street Journal opined today, there apparently was a war room of motley characters at the Willard Hotel and a small group of plotters who wanted to storm the barricades, but they were too organized to do much more than incite what became the mob that breached the Capitol. And the Wall Street Journal is much more sanguine about the 1-6 Commission than I am. So that's what we understand. I'm not done yet. Then you can respond. So you have 700 people out of the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands that were there that broke the law, at least according to those who've been, you know, by the numbers of people who've been arrested. There, the FBI finds no effective coordination. We have all sorts of intel and police failures, as so described yesterday by the Capitol Police Chief in testimony before a Senate committee. And we also, all these protests or people that participated in protests or rallies over the last year since Biden's election, we have nothing akin to what happened on 1-6. And so explain to me this looming insurrection that's occurring with the evidence that we actually have in possession and the pronouncements from agencies that haven't exactly been particularly favorable to the former president, like the FBI.
So the evidence comes from the testimony of the people who broke into the Capitol themselves. All of your listeners should go to the Twitter of Jenny Cudd, C-U-D-D. She's a woman. She owns a floral shop in Midland, Texas. She's the former candidate for mayor in Midland, Texas. And on her Twitter account to this day, at least as of just a few minutes ago, you'll see multiple posts that she did where she videos herself on the day of the insurrection and also afterwards, but explaining why she broke into the Capitol. She says directly it's to stop the certification of the
election. Well, so what? So she's a crank.
Hold it. I listen to you. Don't I get a chance to say something?
Well, explain why this is. Give me the context of why this is important. This is one person. So what?
Because you have, well, no, there are hundreds.
Yeah, okay, there's hundreds of persons in a country of 330 million people. Give me context.
Hold it. I mean, I did pause to let you finish, and so if I could just please finish. Your listeners should go to Jenny Cudd's Twitter, and they will see for themselves hard evidence. They can also go to our website at the University of Chicago for CPOS, that is Chicago Project on Security and Threats, and we have a public website with all of the data, and they will see hundreds of statements by the court records that relate to the statements given by the people who broke in, many in their plea agreements when they're admitting their guilt. Saying directly that they went because their president, Trump, told them to go and storm the Capitol. They went to stop the certification of the election. And you don't have to trust the FBI. You just listen to the people themselves. Being quiet about it.
Right. And that's in the context of a plea agreement where they're trying to offload blame for the choices that they made. Give me a break. Not to mention they're trying to give prosecutors what they want over at Department of Justice for this bigger play that the 1-6 Commission is trying to advance as well. So you have to consider those contextual factors. Somebody's entering a plea agreement. team and they want to say, oh, I was duped and I'm sorry and so on and so forth. They are sentient, sapient beings. They made terrible choices. They're paying the consequences. I don't know how you extrapolate from that, particularly given that context, to say 21 million people or 6 million or some subset of them are afoot in the country planning to overthrow the government. How ridiculous. In addition to that, by the way, some people thought they could go to D.C. and stop the certification of the election. Well, so what? Some people were wrong. Some people have crazy ideas. Some people don't understand the Electoral Count Act, don't understand how our constitutional representative republic works. So what? That is miles away from the conclusions that you're drawing.
I would be just simply ask your listeners not to trust me, not to trust you, not to trust the FBI, to for themselves do their own research and look at the court documents, which show picture after picture after picture of the individuals beating officers, hurting officers, and also saying over and over and over again why they went in. And there's no other explanation they give.
So that's 700 people.
So hold
that's
it. 700 people. Hold it.
Oh, my. Come on.
Sorry, just want
to. Well, you don't get to filibuster. Your side wants to eliminate the filibuster. I'm going to eliminate it here. Okay. Oh, good. Thank you. So, I get it. And you're sawing sawdust. We're saying the same things. I don't support violence against police officers. The Trump supporters, by and large, maybe with the exception of a few on the fringe, don't support it either. And people who got whipped up and made terrible decisions to breach the Capitol or worse on January 6th are being prosecuted under the law. So number one, the election was certified. Number two, people who broke the law are being prosecuted. And number three, there's no other evidence you present other than your survey research and people attending protests, for goodness sakes, that you don't suggest were violent over the last year to substantiate this claim that there's this looming threat. And you dismiss out of hand the FBI, which is an antagonist organization towards these individuals, not to mention the former president, that finds no evidence of the sort of concerted effort that you're suggesting is afoot. But other than that, okay, sure.
So I haven't dismissed anything you've said out of hand. I haven't dismissed the FBI out of hand.
You said don't listen to the FBI.
Well, I only got about 8 words in, so if I could have a few more words. I haven't dismissed anything you've said out of hand. I'm listening to you. I haven't dismissed anything the FBI has said out of hand. All I'm suggesting to your listeners is to go to the Chicago Project on Security and Threats website, and they can look for themselves at the evidence and make up their own mind.
Fine. Go ahead.
We want to listen. We want to listen to people. So I'm not in the business of trying to shout at you. I'm definitely glad to listen.
Yeah, I don't care if it's room temperature. I don't care if your rhetoric is room temperature or it's up a few decibels. That's irrelevant. I'm listening to you, too. I watched your interview with Margaret Brennan. I've gone to your site. I suggest other people do the same to make their own opinions, to make their own judgments based on what you have in addition to the larger evidence. But I want to get to one other point that you made, because you suggest there's a racial component to this group that you've described as these 21 million insurrectionists afoot. And I want you to describe that.
Yes, but we also ask in our nationally representative survey questions about their beliefs, like are they worried about losing a job, do they believe in the end times, and the number one belief in the 21 million who hold these insurrectionist sentiments, fully believed by 75% of the 21 million, is the idea of the Great Replacement, the idea that the Democratic Party and liberals in general are deliberately replacing the current electorate with immigrants so that they can change the majority in the country from a white majority to a non-white majority. That idea of the Great Replacement has been around in fringe circles for quite some time. What's new and different is not the concept of the Great Replacement, but that it is now part of the mainstream. It's not just part of the fringe. And we're also hearing this from mainstream political figures. We're seeing this from mainstream, very popular media figures. And so what we're seeing is a disturbingly large movement of an insurrectionist movement in the mainstream of America. And as we head into the 2022 election season, we have to see this is a tinderbox of an election season. We have a situation where
hold on a second. The basis to make that claim that they're motivated by belief in the great replacement theory, because from your what you had to say to Margaret Brennan on Face the Nation over the weekend, you suggest it's because in part, or the correlation is, that these individuals hail from counties that Biden may have won, but that are seeing an exodus of white people. And so are you extrapolating from conclusion?
No, that's part of the picture, but not the core picture.
Okay.
And so, as is the case on Face the Nation, we get 6 minutes, so we don't get, you know, an hour.
I know.
And as is the case here, so if you go to our website, and if your listeners will go to our website, they'll see the full details here. And it's just hard in sound bites to get the full details out of a fairly detailed and in-depth study. So this isn't just a, you know, a quick three-question survey. We're asking, you know, 40 questions. They're really detailed. We're examining them. And so this is really why I'm able to tell you with some confidence what those 21 million people believe. I'm not guessing. I'm not bringing it out. They're directly being asked this in a nationally representative survey. These are the gold standard of surveys, not the cheapies that are done where you just kind of dial a few people listening on some voter registration polls. And what you see are some really powerful findings. You also see, for instance, that their main media source is not right-wing social media like Gab.
Yeah, it's Fox News, I know.
Their main media source are Fox, Newsmax, One America. And that's really important to see, because we have people on Fox articulating powerfully the great replacement theory almost every night. And so as if you see mainstream politicians who are followed articulating it, I don't think it should come as a big surprise that we have people in the mainstream who are now being angered by these ideas, and some of them are acting on them.
All right, you get the last word. He is Professor Robert Pei, professor of political science at the University of Chicago, specializing in international security affairs, and the director of the Chicago Project on Security and Threats, CPOST, as he was describing. Professor Pei, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. And he joined us, excuse me, on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.